Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Opening day for Major League Baseball is right around the corner. Dirk Lammers is the author of the book No Hit Wonders, More Than a Century of Pitching's Greatest Feats. Chuck Brodsky is a musician known as baseball's poet laureate. Last year, the two joined me in the studio at about this time to kick off the season. We had such a good time and such a positive response from the conversation, we thought we'd offer it to you again. Dirk, let's start with you. You kind of grew up watching baseball through the bars of your crib, is that right?
Yeah, I was born into a Mets family. I grew up in New Jersey, just outside of New York. So my dad was a big Mets fan, and I got to follow that team and share both the joys and the heartaches, many more heartaches than joys of being a Mets fan.
The first time you went to the ballpark, do you remember?
I do. 1975 against the Cubs. Jerry Kuzman pitched a four-hit shutout. I would have been six.
6 years old.
Yes.
And do you remember it now, or do you
told
the stories?
I do, and I have 8mm footage in which I just recently bought a projector to remind me of that. So it's been fun to relive that.
So what are some of your earliest memories about baseball that would include the concept of a no-hitter? When did you first kind of understand what that even meant?
Well, oddly, my dad and my two sisters saw a no-hitter in 1969. It was against the Mets by a Pirates pitcher named Bob Moose. But I've never seen one in person. But being a Mets fan, one of my favorite pitchers was Tom Seaver. And he could not throw a no-hitter for the Mets. He reached the ninth inning on several times, always got destroyed, and then we traded him to the Cincinnati Reds for no good reason. The next year he threw a no-hitter, and that was the first heartbreak I had that we're never going to get a no-hitter. And it took until 2012 till we finally did. It was the longest streak for almost 50 years from a franchise's inception.
So how often did you talk about that as a family? How often was that part of your dinner conversation?
Well, I don't think my dad, because my dad saw a no-hitter, I think it was more of me and my frustration of not seeing a no-hitter. And it just grew over the years because there were so many near misses or some weird bounce that went the other way.
Right.
And eventually it led to me starting a website in 2008 called nonohitters.com, in which I started tracking the streak game by game, tweeting out every time a no-hitter got destroyed, 162 games a year. And then eventually, when Johan Santana threw it for the Mets in 2012, I finally got the website blew up, all kinds of traffic, and then all kinds of media coverage, and then I had to figure out what to do with it. So
people were responding to it because of the writing and the quality of what you had done, obviously, but also because of the sort of cultural moment that it was.
Yeah, well, the Mets, the Mets have always been second tier to the Yankees. Uh-huh. In that city. So Mets fans embrace some of that kind of a George Costanza type complex, in which something that can go wrong would. So I think the no-hitter streak is kind of got that, and it was special to Mets fans because we're used to kind of being, not the team that won 27 championships,
right.
That other team that won two and is not as popular.
So tell me a little bit about the book and how it came to be then.
Well, eventually with that website, I had to do something with it because people wanted me to keep it up. So I kind of transitioned it to celebrating all of no-hitters in baseball. And I had all kinds of stats and lists. But one of the things about, I think, anything, but particularly baseball, the beauty of it is stories. And I couldn't always capture the stories, so I decided to write a book and just say, let me look at all of the no-hitters, kind of pick the best stories of no-hitters thrown, no-hitters lost, weird streaks, the whole thing on superstition, both in the dugout as well as in the broadcast booth. Some people think don't ever mention a no-hitter in progress. Others are, come on, you got to say what's going on. That's your job as an announcer. So there's all kinds of issues that I thought were fun to explore.
Let's talk a little bit about stories and switch over to Chuck for a minute, because we're talking music, but we're also talking stories in music. Elaborate a little bit on what you do as a performer.
Well, exactly that, really. I've been called a storyteller. It's not something that I really thought of for myself, but I'm very, very much attracted to stories, and I guess the majority of the songs that I write tend to be story-type songs. I've gotten a bit more into some spoken stories and, you know, done some storytelling festivals in recent years. But I would say that, you know, baseball probably was the genesis of all of this for me, because I started writing baseball story songs a number of years ago, and it really wasn't anything that I charted out. I wrote one, and I was shocked at people's response to it. I wrote a second one. I was twice as shocked by the response I got. And then I just started thinking, this is fun. I love baseball. You mean I can get away with this as a professional musician and songwriter? I can focus on writing baseball songs and people are going to not, you know, not think that's trite, trivial. Awesome. So it's not the only thing I do. Yeah. In fact, in a live concert, it would be a very small part of what I do. I might play 3-4 baseball songs in a typical concert, but I have released 2 full albums of baseball songs.
11 CDs total, is that correct?
11, yeah.
Yeah, 11. You've been compared to Mark Twain. You've been compared to Flannery O'Connor. You've been compared to John Steinbeck. What does it mean for a musician and singer to be compared to such literary giants?
Well, it's, you know, it's absolutely flattering. But, you know, you have to be careful.
They're lofty, yes.
They're very lofty. And, you know, I would never see myself in those ways. I'm just me doing what I do. And I'm very grateful that people seem to appreciate it and hold what I do in high enough regard that they would compare me to anybody like that. It's, like I said, it's extremely flattering. But, you know, you can't read and believe press about you. It's like in sports, you know. It's very similar.
Why don't we let a song speak for itself? Do you want to tell us what you're going to sing?
Yeah. Dirk quoted some of my lyrics in a chapter in his book about a pitcher by the name of Doc Ellis who pitched for the Pittsburgh Pirates back in the 1970s. And on June 12th, 1970, Doc Ellis did something rather remarkable. Not only did he throw a no-hitter, but he did so while under the influence of LSD. And this is a true story.
It was a lovely summer's morning, an off day in L.A. So thought one Doc Ellis, see what later say. His girlfriend read the paper, she said, Doc, this can't be right. Says here that you're pitching in San Diego tonight. We got to get you to the airport, so off Doc Ellis flew. His legs were a little bit wobbly and the rest of him was too. Took a taxi to the ballpark, an hour before the game. Gave a half-assed explanation, found the locker with his name. The organ in the upper deck played all the schmaltzy hits. You could hear it in the clubhouse while Doc was getting dressed. His sunglasses he reached for from his locker in a case. Doc Ellis put a jersey on, then he put them on his face. Time came to go on out there, down the corridor. The walls were a little bit wavy and there were ripples in the floor. Went out to the bullpen to do a bunch of stretches. Loosen up a little, throw some warm-up pitches. All rose for the national anthem. People took off their hats. Fireworks were exploding and the cokes were already going flat. Doc was back there in the dugout. So many things to watch. Some players spit tobacco juice and others grabbed their crotch. Then the umpire hollered play ball, and so it came to be. Doc's Pirates batted first when they went down 1-2-3. Doc's catcher put his mask on and he handed Doc the ball, and it was 327 feet to the left and right field wall. So Doc's Pirates took the field then, and Doc stood on the rubber, and he bounced a couple of pitches, and he bounced a couple of others. He might say about that day that it looked a little wild. The lead-off batter trembled, and nobody knew why. Doc Ellis smiled. We walk eight and you hit a guy, oh, the things that people shout. Especially the manager, but it did not take Doc out. Doc found himself a rhythm and a crazy little spin. Amazing things would happen when Doc Geller zeroed in. Sometimes he saw the catcher, sometimes he did not. Sometimes he held a beach ball, and other times it was a dot. Doc was tossing comets that were leaving trails of glitter. In the seventh inning stretch, he still had his no-hitter. So he turns to Cash, his buddy, says, I got a no-no going. Speaking the unspeakable, and he goes back out there throwing. Bottom of the ninth, and he stood high upon the mound. Three more outs to go, and he'd have his name in Cooperstown. Well, first up was Cannizzaro, and he flied out to a loo. Then Kelly grounded out for Dean, and the shortstop yelled, that's two. Must have been a madhouse, fans upon their feet. Little ones among them were standing on their seats. And that would have brought up Herbal, but Spezio pinch hit. He took a third strike looking, and officially, that was it. It was a lovely summer's morning, an off day in L.A. So that one Doc Ellis, he would later say.
Dirk, stories from the book. That story is in there, I take it?
It is, yes. And I was so happy that I got to lead it off with a quote from that song, because it was just so wonderful to get that perspective of it. Among there are some interviews with Doc. He actually later became a drug counselor, and that was his job till later in life. So he turned that around for the good as well.
How did you find, Dirk, some of these stories? What kind of research did you do to dig?
Read a lot of newspaper stories. You know, tried to find newspaper clippings from each no-hitter as well as box scores. Tried to find any interviews in books where you know, autobiographies, when someone's talked about the no-hitter. Just basically wherever I could find it, and did a lot of, you know, in-person interviews and phone interviews whenever I could. One of my favorites was getting to interview, I did it by phone, but Don Larson, who threw the only perfect game in World Series back in 1956. So that was exciting.
How'd you prepare for that? Were you just
just nervous and just
out?
Dialed the phone, you know? It's, you just, you know, I've been a journalist. I've done a lot of interviews. So you're, you know, whenever you're interviewing someone famous, there's always a little more butterflies. But once you get that first question in and it gets a response, I think it's a lot easier.
And Chuck, the role of a folk musician today has also changed and evolved. How do you see that your voice as a folk musician fits into the sort of cultural context?
That's a wonderful question. I think I'm very old school, and I think my values are very old school. And unfortunately, over the years, I've watched the music industry encroach into the world of folk music, and so I've kind of resisted. I don't see myself as being part of the music industry. I'm outside of that. I am certainly an independent musician, and I've been traveling around for 25 years doing it. But it's not about getting famous, and it's not about getting rich, and it's not about anything other than the art behind this, the creativity. I want to be true to my art, and I want to touch people's hearts and make people laugh, make people cry. That's the real level that this happens on, and everything else about it doesn't really appeal to me. I mean, of course, I want to make a comfortable living, and I want things to work out, but I know that society kind of gears people towards these more false rewards, and I think folk music is based in more real rewards. But like I said, unfortunately, it's been co-opted a little bit by the business of music, and so I've tried to just keep things real, grassroots, and because of that, I end up traveling to places that maybe some other musicians wouldn't see the benefit in going to. You know, a lot of people focus on the big cities and the name clubs, and I'm the opposite. I'll go anywhere and everywhere as long as there are people to appreciate it, and you know, that the travel and the monetary end of it works out. That's, you know, it has to work out, because I do only this for my living, but it's not about, and never has been about, the money or the fame or whatever.
You want to play something else for us and give us an idea of what it's going to be?
Sure. There was another great ball player who played for the Pittsburgh Pirates. His name was Roberto Clemente. He was also a tremendous humanitarian. And Roberto Clemente lost his life on New Year's Eve, I think it was 1972? Yeah. He had just gotten the 3,000th hit of his career on the final game of the season. And there had been a terrible earthquake in Nicaragua. And Roberto Clemente organized some relief effort. There were some flights full of relief aid flying from Puerto Rico to Nicaragua that had been intercepted by the military junta in Nicaragua, and all the aid was confiscated and distributed to soldiers and not to whom it was intended. And so Roberto Clemente decided that with the fourth plane load, he would actually fly with it, try to make sure that it got into the proper hands. And unfortunately, the plane crashed into the sea just after taking off. But I wrote the song just as a way of honoring Roberto. I've learned recently that the Pittsburgh Pirates did something wonderful to honor him, too. He wore the number 21, and he was their right fielder. And when they built their stadium 10 or 12 years ago or so, they built the right field wall 21 feet tall as a tribute to him. So this is called Roberto.
Maldonado off the Puerto Rican coast. People sometimes stand there and offer up a toast to the greatest baseball player they ever called their own. He went off on a mission and he never made it home. The earthquake was horrific. The aid was pouring in. Roberto helped organize a whole plane load to send. The Nicaraguan junta had been looting all it could, so he fly with it to make sure it got to all the neighborhoods. It would not pass inspection, the plane that he would hire. Pilot that came with it, his license had expired. A local huckster owned it, and they wasn't sure it flew. But he kept that to himself, but the paint on it was new. The plane was overloaded, the cargo not secured. Standard operating procedures, they were totally ignored. The engine didn't sound right, said the people on the ground. When it took off from Managua, tried to circle back around. Well, people still remember where they were that New Year's Eve. When the word began to spread, hardly anyone believed. Helicopters hovered all throughout the nights, just above the waters, sweeping with their lights. Well, they never found Roberto, but the search went on for days, frantically at first, until they found his leather case. No one could bear to call it off, so they carried on, but the divers never found him. Roberto, he was gone. Punto Maldonado, off the Puerto Rican coast. People sometimes stand there, looking for the ghost of the greatest baseball player they ever called their own. They went off on a mission, and they never made it home.
That's Dirk Lammers and Chuck Brodsky, who joined us in the studio as we looked ahead to another season in baseball. Dirk Lammers is the author of No Hit Wonders, More Than a Century of Pitching's Greatest Feats. Chuck Brodsky is the America's unofficial baseball poet laureate. 20 of his tunes are enshrined in the National Baseball Hall of Fame's Sound Recording Library.